What are you doing?
I'm working on my own reindeer team. You know, like I'm Santa.
Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Let's hear it.
You know, Alpha and Chiseled, Six-Pack and G-Spot, Handsome and Bigly, He-Man and Real Hot.
Nice.
Oh, all right here. Let me just help you. Hand me your pencil. Ah, there it is. Better. You know, Lardy and Geezer, Gassy and Bald Spot, Alky and Shorty, Saggy and Gray Top.
Thanks?
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them. Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! God is helping!
We are the wild and pretty guys!
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
And we are the Festive Foreign Film Fans!
Well, hey! Mark, it's May!
Wow, how did we get to May so fast?
I know, but you know what? Thinking about Mother's Day, it made me think about the kids' game, and I don't know if you ever played this. It was called Mother May I. The whole concept got me thinking about these kids' games that you'll meet someone at college that is from another side of the country, and they know how to play red light, green light, or follow the leader, or duck, duck, goose. And I go, how is it that these games are passed out? Like, how is it that somebody living somewhere completely different are playing similar or the same kind of games?
It's just interesting you bring that up, Bob. I never heard of the game Mother May I. And I even asked Sue about it, and she knew a kind of a version of it where you started off by saying how many steps before the queen, and then the queen would say, you do three spins and a tumble, and then you would say, oh, mother, may I, and do it. So she sort of heard of the concept, but this was a new one to me.
I started to look into that, and Sue's exactly right. There's a lot of variations, but where does this all come from? The origins, you can't say, well, this was the person who invented it. They don't really have that. Typically, they can pin down the first time it appears in print, and it seems that Mother May I came in the 19th century, and they establish it. It's either in Europe or in America. The origin is unknown, but it has been recorded for over a century, this game,
oh
Mother
my
May
gosh,
I.
That's crazy.
And for you, if you don't know, and kind of what Sue described is exactly how it is. The players line up, and then the one person is on the other side of, say, the room, or if you're outside, you know, across the field, and that person is the mother. You call out to that person, and you say, can I take three scissor steps forward? And you have to say, Mother May I? And then the mother would say, yes, you may, or no, you may not. Or, like Sue says, they can change what you need to do. But the rules are, if you can't move unless they say, yes, you may. And if you ever either move without asking, because sometimes you'll say, can I take three big steps forward? And you don't say, mother, may I? And the mother will say, yes, just to trick you. You didn't say, mother, may I? You're caught. You got to go back to the line. And the idea is the first one who reaches the mother wins. So what I am thinking about with the concept of the game, and since we're on the topic Mother's Day, there are these fascinating books that try to break down or deconstruct these types of games to say, what was the purpose? Children are impulsive, so the game is to teach the children good listening skills, patience, taking turns, and it's also meant to reinforce manners and being polite so you can understand the difference between mother may I or can I and just going ahead and doing it. And this is where it gets fascinating. It also establishes clear leadership. So you think about this. It's established leadership, but who is picked to represent the position of authority or permission? It's the mother. And I'm thinking in my head, well, dads are always supposed to be considered the head of the household, right?
That's so, right. Man's rights.
But then you think about it and you say, okay, what does that mean? Well, I guess that means we just stand in the doorway with our arms crossed and say something like, go ask your mom.
Yeah, so what? What's wrong with that?
So if we really think about it, okay, yeah, mom's the one usually juggling a full-time job, keeping the house from turning into a disaster. Disaster zone, doing the laundry, seems like it multiplies overnight, and still managing to put dinner on the table. Now, this isn't all true in all households, and a lot of times it just seems like the moms have to know where everything is and know what everyone's schedule is and where they need to be even 3 weeks from now. So we dads, we get the credit, but mom is usually the one running the show behind the scenes.
Well, I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Well, Mark, I didn't think to ask you. Guess who we asked to answer this question?
Our pets?
No, because we know they would pick us. Of course they would. But our children? Who was the real enforcer at home? Was it mom or was it dad? And have you ever played Mother May I? And this is what they said.
This is Brian Chandler, son of Mark. While dad might have been the disciplinarian, mom's the one who really brought down the hammer. If you got Sue mad and angry, then you knew you really messed up.
In terms of who was in charge at home, that was definitely mom. Like sometimes she would use the threat of telling dad. Like, she would float that out there. That one was never really taken seriously because, for the most part, Bob, you know, he leans Santa Claus. And so when it came time to punish us, it wasn't as scary of a threat to say that you're going to tell Dad. Mom typically brought the hammer down.
I would say that the day-to-day minor infractions were more taken care of by my mom because we were with her more consistently. And I would say that if there was a time where we got on her nerves so much that she had to say like, okay, well, you know, wait till your dad gets home. If there was something major or we had just done a lot in a day, we knew that there might be some repercussions later when my dad got home from work. But even then, I just remember my dad probably being the softer of the two, generally speaking.
Have I ever played Mother May I? And I have not. But it is funny that in that game, you have to ask mother for permission. And that totally makes sense. Moms really make the rules. I always think of the quote from My Big Fat Greek Wedding where the dad, they need to ask permission. And the daughter says, yeah, but dad's the head of the household. Her mom says, yes, but I'm the neck. She can steer the head wherever she needs to.
That was emasculating. I feel like we need to ask Mother May I just to continue our podcast. Although, Mark, it was nice to give a nod to the women in our life, wasn't it?
Oh, of course. They're outstanding moms and wives.
And not that we needed that reinforced for us, but it's nice to hear. But I'd like to know, what the heck happened to their fathers?
Well, that's a whole nother podcast that I don't want to get into.
Yeah, we'll let our wives handle that one. But before we move on to tonight's location, we have to return back to the country that's considered one of Africa's cleanest, safest, and most forward-looking nations, Rwanda, and home to that endangered mountain gorillas in the wild. So last episode, we wanted to know what the Rwanda Football Federation banned in 2016 to curb the use of in that sport, the sport of soccer. And if you knew, we had a small, colorful sticker that can catch your eye instantly and stick in your memory just like a gorilla in the forest. And what I love about the answer to this question is because, as I just described, Rwanda now is considered one of the best, most forward-looking nations in Africa. But despite all its modernness, as forward-thinking as it is, the Rwanda Football Federation passed strict measures against the use of witchcraft in soccer. There actually are penalties. There are fines. If you're using witchcraft, you will be fined.
Oh, my God.
Well, good thing they haven't banned it in the use of podcasts, because what would we do with our wizarding robes?
Oh, my goodness.
Let's take these wizarding robes, belt them up, put on some shorts and sandals for a breezy summer look, because we are off to the Philippines. A place full of turquoise waters, white sand beaches, street food, music, and Christmas. Lots and lots of Christmas. Want to hear about our movie, Mark?
I'm really excited. I love the Philippines, and I love the people of the Philippines. They're just always so happy and jovial, so I can't wait till we talk about this movie tonight.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
All right. Before we get into the movie, and Mark, maybe you shouldn't reveal your cards right away, but I have to say, I found this movie charming. I have to just tell you, I really did. There's parts of it that strike you a little bit like a Hallmark movie, but I actually felt like it was meaningful to me. First, I got to talk about the actors.
Can I talk about the movie, Mother? May Mother? I? No, you may not.
Okay, so we have our romantic couple here, and the male lead, who is the character's name, Gina Fonte, he's played by Piolo Jose Naneto Pascual. And Piolo is multi-talented. He's a Filipino actor, model, singer, television host, comedian, and film producer. And I'm curious, there is a song in this movie. I don't know if you caught it. It sounded like he was singing it. It sounded like his voice. I was going to check to see if he sang the song.
I wonder if that was him.
So when he was in junior high, Pascual started appearing in the teen variety show That's Entertainment. He was in an acting career, but it got interrupted at age 18 when he moved to the U.S. to join his mother, because his parents had split up and his mother was in the U.S. While he was here, he worked multiple jobs. He worked in an ER, and he also was a security guard for the Academy Awards. And then when he turned 21, he returned back to Manila to restart his acting career, and he rose to fame starring in a soap opera called Esperanza. He went on to star in several other television series and films, including an acclaimed supernatural drama series and a noir crime thriller called On the Job, which was screened at the Cannes Film Festival in France. And his debut album, Piolo, went platinum. His second album, My Gift, went platinum as well. And his fifth solo album, called Timeless, it reached triple platinum status.
Oh, my God.
I know. And he seems like such a nice, charming guy here. But anyway. And then our female lead, she plays Elise, and her name is Donita Rose Cabot. And Donita Rose Cabot was born in Utah, and then she moved to the Philippines when she was 5 years old. This might be one of the first times we had an actor from a country that was actually born in the U.S. As a teenager, her acting debut also began in the Filipino teen variety show That's Entertainment. She then moved to Singapore to work as a VJ. Remember, that was a VJ and MTV Asia. And then later she started two Filipino sitcoms before starting in movies. Rose has appeared on the cover of the men's magazine FHM in its Singapore, Malaysian, Thai, and Filipino editions. And she was also named Sexiest Woman of 2001. Now, the reason why I thought to insert that in here, so that was her, Rose, in 2001. Currently, she works as the corporate chef for Island Pacific, which is a chain of grocery stores in the U.S. that specialize in Filipino food. And she's a born-again Christian, and an active member of the Victory Fellowship Church. All you sexist women, you have an opportunity to be born again as a Christian.
And to work in a grocery store as a chef. That is one of the more dynamic backgrounds of two actors in a film, I think, than we've had in all 3 years.
I love both of them. We will now get into the movie that I've been itching to tell you about. It is called 9 Days.
Hey, Bob, I mean, not to be a pain in the butt about anything, but it's actually called 9 Mornings.
Oh, my gosh. Mark, you are correct.
People listening, this is why we get along so well.
Mark pays attention to the details, and I do not.
Now I'm hearing what my kids tell me. You never get the names right, Dad. Wonder they like Mom more. Go ahead. Back to you, Bob.
One thing I should put out there, the reason why it's called 9 Mornings, and we'll talk about this in the traditions, the customs. One of the things that they have in the Philippines is they call this Simbang Gabi. And it's 9 masses that you go to leading up to Christmas. It is a custom that they do. And this reference to 9 mornings are actually to this holiday tradition. So the movie starts, see a man showering, and he's imagining a woman running into the surf. And then we see him in an office place, and he's screaming at his employees. They're setting up for a Christmas festival, and he's screaming at the employees. He's screaming at the people in his office. And there's a young girl who is a beggar who's coming up to sell items to people who are stopped in traffic. He doesn't even look at the young girl, say anything. He just throws money at her and closes the window. He's not exactly the nicest, friendliest person. He has 2 friends that he hangs out with, and they're Tara and Hernan, and they talk a lot about the money that they have. He runs an office, owns a business, so he is successful, but his grandmother has also left him 3 million in pesos and land as well. But she has one condition as part of her will, is that he has to attend these 9 Simbang Gabi, these masses. He has to go to them. As he indicates to his friends, hey, 3 million, I got money. I don't need the 3 million. It's the land that is valuable. The lawyer tells him that the farmers who rent the land have been there for 40 years, but his plan is to sell the land. He's like, that's where the big cash is, not the 3 million. This is where the land is. We see some more scenes of him. He keeps seeing a young woman running into the water on the beach. And then, first mass. First day, he has to go in. At the church, the lawyer is there, and the lawyer tells him that the priest is going to watch for him to make sure that he makes all 9 masses, which I thought was funny, that the priest is keeping attendance. This film, every single scene in the church, they're either singing a carol, very festive. You see a lot of decoration. It really gives you a good Christmas spirit.
It really does. And you know what's really interesting, too, for people who maybe are Catholic faith, they're completing a novena. In Catholic religion, you complete a novena for causes and things. And so this is what the 9 mornings are. The other thing I'd say about each one of the episodes, every time they go to the church, besides being festive, it's also a different iteration of how a mass occurs. So it starts at the beginning, then it goes to one thing, then goes to another. And so as it goes through the mass and every time they go back to church, they're progressing through an entire mass.
Mark, I did notice that. And what I was wondering, at one point I thought, is each one a full mass and they're segmenting it for our purpose? Or was it just one part of the mass? It was great because it progressed as the mass progressed. Each one was a different one.
I thought it was interesting because I thought it was like as the mass progresses, is he progressing as a person? But let's keep going with it.
Each mass, something important happens at each one. In the first mass, there's a young girl who notices Jean dozing off and points it out to the woman who she's with. And he looks at her and she looks at him. Obviously, there's a little bit of attraction, and he then later meets up with them after mass, talks to them. The next thing you know, the girl is telling the woman's girlfriends about, oh, there's a cute guy that we saw at mass. So while she's talking about the man she noticed at church, he's in the office and he has a assistant who works for him, a woman, and she's wrapping a gift for the Kris Kringle gift exchange in the office. And he looks down at it, shrugs it off again, being nasty. Later, he's out with his friends and they're all talking about how great it is to be rich.
I know. They're not shallow.
No, not at all. And then he drives out with his friends where the land is to meet the people who are there, who are the renters on the land, as he's kind of scoping it out, getting prepared to sell it. And he meets the farmer. The farmer has six kids. Not only does he have six kids, he has a wife who's suffering from cancer who isn't there. And one of the kids tells them that his name is Elvis. And Gene's like, oh, I bet you're going to be a singer. And he says, no, I want to be a farmer like my father was a farmer, like his father was a farmer. So all of this is sinking in on Gene that they have a long tradition on this land of farming this land. This man has six children and his wife is suffering from cancer. So does it impact him? No, he goes right back to where these people are setting up the festival, screaming at his workers. What is kind of nice is there is the story of Gene and Elise and their meeting, but there's also Tara and Hernan. They seem like they've all been friends for a long time, but Hernan is falling for Tara. He's falling in love with her. And what seems to come out of nowhere, she describes how she doesn't have faith in God being a man because she was molested by her own father at 8 years old. And she's an artist. And it's interesting because you later see at an art show, her art and its images of Jesus as a woman. It's the next morning. And when I say morning, Gene has to wake up. His alarm says 4 a.m. So the mass starts at 5 a.m. to go to mass. Second mass, he again is talking to Elise. He learns that she is a teacher and she teaches orphans. And he invites her to his Christmas event at the mall. We're starting to learn that he is involved in setting up events. And one of the events is a big Christmas event at the mall. And it leads for some comic interlude where they have different groups performing their Christmas music. He, again, is insulting to his employees. And you don't know now if he's feeling some pressure because Elise is going to come and he wants to impress her, but he still is nasty. We learn a little bit more about Elise. She's from Canada and her parents are in Canada. One thing we do see is Gene is a little bit nicer to the young girl, the beggar who comes to the window. This time, at least he looks at her and he takes what she's selling him. Then the third mass, so it's the third morning, he is seen reciting some parts of the mass. So you realize he had been to church. That's the first instance we see of him participating. Next, we see him at the event looking for Elise, very excited. And for the first time, he seems a bit nicer to his employees. He's changing slightly.
Bob, you should probably mention what Elise does. And she works in an orphanage. And there's a little girl named Sandy. And Sandy's sort of under Elise's wing as she's working at the orphanage.
I did forget to mention, she's an orphan, and she's described several times as being special. She is special.
Right.
And we kind of learn also that Gene, he lost his parents. His parents were killed in a car accident, and he was raised by his grandmother. And he was relating that Sandy, she was abandoned by, her mother was 15. She was abandoned when she was born. So he relates some of his personal story. And his friend is telling him, I can't believe you would be interested in a teacher. That's just not you. But he starts to tell Gene how he's in love with Tara. Gene, it's a very active imagination with the woman running in the beach. He also sees his grandmother speaking to him. And one of the things his grandmother says to him is, it's not what you possess, but what you leave behind. The woman that he hooks up with invites him to come out, and he turns her down. You get the impression that that's the first time that's ever happened. And right, the girl's exactly. like, too bad for you, kind of, you know. We also get scenes of Elise looking at a picture of a man, and you didn't know if it's her husband, but later it comes out it was a boyfriend. They broke up. And that's why her hesitation, she doesn't want to get hurt again. She doesn't want to get into another relationship and have her heart broken. So the fourth mass, so we're on the fourth day, Tara and Hernan, they come to the mass. They come with Jean. And Sandy is telling Jean, she was asking him if he was afraid to go to heaven. And she says she's not afraid because that's the only way she'll get to see her parents. It was sad. And Jean then goes and visits Elise at school, and she gets to see him interacting with the kids, which is good. And again, that's where he hears about Sandy being the special child. And we also learn that Jean has been a non-practicing Catholic since his girlfriend died. And slowly, more scenes with him interacting with his employees, being nicer to his employees. And this is over a four-day period, because now we're at the fifth day of Mass, and Elise, she takes down the picture of her ex-boyfriend and puts them away. She says that she was angry that she gave so much of herself to this ex-boyfriend. She goes to Tara's art show, and Tara, she's plans to donate all the sales of her art to the orphanage. So not only does it seem like Jean is changing, but Tara and Hernan are slightly changing too, because previously we're so excited about how great it was to be rich. Here she is doing a selfless act to give money to the orphanage, and they're getting married. They're going to get married December 30th. I mean, everything's happening in short periods of time.
That's such a funny part of the movie.
I know.
Like any good movie, you know, you have different storylines, but their whole romance and proposal, all of a sudden, we don't want to get married. We don't want to get married. Oh, we're getting married in 6 days.
So yeah, we're only at the sixth day, the sixth mass. Jean's nicer, much more mellow. We see Elise runs into her old boyfriend. Uh-oh, what's going to happen? He's like, wow, I thought you left for Canada. I want to take you out to dinner, explain what happened. And guess what? She says no. So things are changing for Elise and for Jean. He's getting happier. She seems to be getting happier. We get to the seventh mass. He goes through that. His company has their Christmas party. And guess what? He's nice to his employees. He's enjoying himself at the Christmas party. His administrative assistant, she tells him that her husband was laid off and she lives far away from the office. And they have a raffle in the office, and it's a prize, a food basket plus money. Someone in the office wins it. And then Gene tells his administrative assistant, oh, we had two grand prize winners, and he gives her the exact same thing, which causes her to break out in tears. Again, Jean is completely changing. Not only that, when he sees the young girl this time, the beggar girl, he gives her food, he gives her money, and he asks her name, and he says Merry Christmas to her. So from going from not even looking her in the eyes to asking who she is and recognizing her and giving her food, things are changing. All of this is happening. There's fireworks because it's Christmas, and somebody fires a gun, and a bullet barely misses Jean. And then it's a rainstorm. He's totally drenched. He goes to Elise. This completely threw him off, this near miss in his life. And this is the time where he tells her what exactly happened. He says, I feel lost. I don't know what's happening in my life. I had a girlfriend. She was young. She was 16. We were at the beach. She drowns. And I had sworn off my religion, sworn off everything, pretty much right. Shut down.
Just be very focused on himself and his own needs.
And then he said, I did some good things today for my administrative assistant, for my employees, for this young girl. And then I nearly get killed. And it brought to light, it made him really face up to the guilt he was feeling over the death of his girlfriend. She was only 15. Her life had just started. And why was it her and not me? He struggles with all of this. But now we're on the eighth day. So we're getting close. There's only nine, like you said, in the novena, there's only nine. Eighth day, he sees the woman that he used to hook up with. He sees her in church. But while they're there, Sandy is sick. And he confesses after Mass to Tara. He finally says, I love Elise, but I've only known her for 8 days. Like, can I actually love her? Can that be the case? While he's having this meeting with Tara, Sandy goes to the hospital, and the ninth Mass comes. He goes to the Mass, and one of the things he had said was at the ninth Mass, he would take Sandy and Elise out afterward to eat. They're not there, and he's sitting there, and you can tell he's agonizing. They're not there. He's struggling. The song that is playing, the lyrics are, is God sleeping? Has he forgotten me? I think it's impactful because of what Gene is going through. And Mark, wasn't it fascinating how half the time they're speaking in English and the other half they're speaking in Filipino? It was like crazy.
I know. At first I thought, did I click something on the movie to make it go to English? I literally paused it. It's like, wait, what just happened there?
It's fascinating how they switch back and forth. You know, they'll say a line in English and a line in Filipino. Boom, boom. Yeah. Gene had told Elise that he couldn't go to communion because he hadn't gone to confession. And so he goes to confession. And at the same time, while Gene is at confession, Sandy, the young girl, she's dying. And we see this. And that is why they were not at Mass, because she's in the hospital and she's dying. Afterwards, he discovers that was the case. She had a congenital heart disease. And he's like, why didn't you tell me? Of all the people, she didn't want you to know. But it also harkens back to several of the things Sandy had said. At one point, she says to Gene, will you take care of Elise for me? And then also when she said, I'm not afraid of heaven, I can see my parents. So almost it was some foretelling there. So they have her funeral. And what's sad here is that both Elise and Jean are alone on Christmas. They tried to get together, and I don't know if it was all the emotions of building up over the 9 days, the death of Sandy, what they're struggling to go through, her seeing her boyfriend, him thinking about his ex-girlfriend, but they don't get together on Christmas. When Elise's phone rings and she picks it up on Christmas, you can tell she's hoping that it's Gene, and it's not. It's her parents.
Parents.
And it's not that she's sad that it's her parents, but she breaks down and she cries, I think, because she so wanted it to be Gene. And so because he didn't call her, she tells her parents she wants to come home. Of course, we see Gene trying to call at that time, and the phone is busy.
Of course, right? I thought things were going to get messed up when the ex-boyfriend came back. And I'm like, no, no, stop it. I'm talking to the movie like my mother used to. Stop it.
That's exactly me too, because you're like, oh, come on. You two deserve each other. You belong together after 8 days. So we see that Gene, before he sees Elise again, he goes to the lawyer and says, I want to give away half that land. I want to give it to the farmer, and I want to give 1,000,000 pesos to the orphanage. So we see in just a short period of time, he's completely turned around. And the lawyer's like, are you crazy? What are you doing this for? In fact, he said, what in heaven are you doing this for? And he realizes his life shouldn't be about money. And he's like, that in heaven is what I'm doing it for. So we have a tearful scene with the farmer that he's giving him the land. He makes a donation in Sandy's name. And the sister at the orphanage remembers that Sandy had a Christmas gift for you. She gives Gene the Christmas gift, which turns out to be an angel ornament. Finally, Elise is leaving for Canada. Gene is going to be left behind. And he comes to the realization, he rushes 6 a.m. to meet Elise, because the vision he had of his grandmother said, don't ask for a miracle to prove there is God. Life is a miracle. Miracles happen every day. You shouldn't ask for proof. In thinking about it, I think he wanted some kind of a miracle to bring him and Elise together. And he has to now just put himself out there, put his emotions out there, and he goes to Elise and he begs her. You could tell he's almost embarrassed, but he's like, I have nothing else. You are all I have. I know I'm showing these emotions. And he was crying and says, please, please don't leave. And he asks her how she feels. And she's like, you know what? You're everything my life was missing as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so Bob.
Hold me, Mark. Bob. I want to weep openly.
Bob, was this movie festive, Bob? Was it festive?
Oh, Mark, could it have been any more festive? And I actually think even saying to you it was like a Hallmark film was kind of not fair. This is, in my mind, and nothing against Hallmark films. They're fine and they fill a niche and I love them too, but this is better than a Hallmark film. I really enjoyed this film. It was festive. It moved me in funny ways. I guess if you were to step back, maybe people listening this go, this seems ridiculous. In 8 days, he falls in love and completely changes. And we have orphans and dying young women. But I don't know. It was great. I loved it.
And I agree with you about the Hallmark. They have their place. This was, I was going to say better, but it was certainly different than a Hallmark movie. And I think a lot of it is because of the incorporation of their Christmas tradition of the nine mornings, which I know you're going to talk about. It was probably one of the more direct Christmas festive movies that we've reviewed in the recent past.
I was about to say, this hit all the elements of a Christmas movie. It had a lot of decorations and songs. It had the customs in there. It had strong emotion. This was a classic Christmas film.
I agree. So besides wanting me to hold you, how did the movie make you feel?
It's one of those ones where you almost want to say, I got choked up. I can sit through movies and I find them still moving, but they don't really get under my skin. This one did. And I don't know what it was, because in describing it, I'm like, maybe it sounds a little cliche, but it didn't come off that way. And I don't know if it was the earnestness of the actors. It felt more real.
I know what you're saying. I agree. So I think the genuine nature of the Filipino people came through their acting. Again, no expert, never been to the Philippines, but have met people who are from the Philippines or their heritage from them. And they're just the kindest, most gentle, respectful people. That's how I felt watching this movie. I felt like I was watching someone's real life story.
I loved how the two friends, Tara and Hernan, they were the comic relief because they were kind of funny, but they were real too. They were like friends would be. Sometimes they're brass and not fun, and like she was swearing at him, but they were good. And they came around in the story as well. So it was great.
I agree.
Mark, would you watch it again?
Absolutely.
This is one I would treat like I treat the U.S. Christmas films, because it puts you in the good mood with the church scenes. It was great. Would you recommend it?
Heck yeah. This will be added to my list to say, hey, you want to watch a Christmas movie that you typically don't see that you're going to love? Maybe I'll put it on when you come over, so maybe I will hug you.
The thing is, because of the way they trade off in the language, you would need to have subtitles, but some people that don't like subtitled films, there's a lot of it in English.
Great point.
And I also love when they're speaking Filipino, but they drop in. I remember at one point she says your clothes are in the dryer, and it's like, Filipino, dryer. And that happened dozens of times where they just drop the English word right in the middle of what they're saying. So, Mark, do you want to know how they say Merry Christmas in the Philippines?
Well, I'm figuring it's just Merry Christmas because they speak English there.
Oh, you're right. It should be blah, 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 Christmas. No, what I'm laughing about in this is like, Mark, somehow the scheduling got screwed up because this is an Asian country. Those are supposed to be assigned to you. Don't you get all the African and the Asian countries? I'm supposed to get Europe. All right, so here we go. Maligayang Pasko. There are 15 different ways to say Merry Christmas in the Philippines. 15. This is Tagalog. Tagalog is the official language, and it's the most widely spoken in the Philippines. Most Filipinos use this greeting, Maligayang Pasko, at Christmas time. And that Maligayang means happy or joyful, and Pasko means Christmas. So when you say Maligayang Pasko, you are literally wishing someone a happy or a joyful Christmas. Now, if you add po to the end, it will make the greeting more polite, and that is used when you address elders. So then you'd say Maligayang Pasko po. Yes.
That was very good.
Thank you. Because I had to say it like four times in a row. So the Tagalog word Pasco is derived of all things from Spanish. And I think we heard this, Pascua. We talked about that before in some of the South American countries. And that's because the Spaniards, they were the original colonists in the Philippines. Remember, Pascua was the word you could use for Easter and Christmas.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. As well as Navidad. That's another Spanish one. And what I did learn, too, is that Pascua is derived from the Hebrew word Pasach, which refers to the Jewish Passover.
That is excellent.
I love the name of their language, Tagalog. I always think that's so funny. I love that name.
I have to say, it reminds me of those Girl Scout cookies.
Exactly.
Sorry.
All right, Mark. So you have promised I am going to talk about this. As we learn from the movie, the Catholics in the Philippines celebrate Simbang Gabi. And it's also known as Misa de Gallo. Now, but that's the Spanish, Misa de Gallo. That's the rooster mass, if we remember that. Mark, I have to admit, and this is very good on your part, and this shows that you went to Catholic school and I did not. I did not realize that a novena was nine masses, but you're right. A novena is nine masses, and these are held from the 16th to the 24th of December. It usually begins at 5 a.m., but sometimes the masses are held as early as 3 a.m. Many Filipinos wake up early and try to complete the entirety of it. And it's believed that if you attend each mass, so if you complete that novena, you can make a wish and it will come true. Now, what stunned me was that this custom started in 1587. There were Spanish missionaries at the San Agustin Acolman Convent, which was on the island of Luzon in the Philippines. And during the days leading up to Christmas, the church was so packed, so overflowing, the missionaries asked the Pope's permission if they could hold services outdoors. When that request was granted, he said yes. They created the Simbang Gabi, and so you come to 9 days before Christmas, and I think it was to break up the crowds. The masses were celebrated at dawn when the roosters crow. In Spanish, it's Misa de Gallo, or the Mass of the Rooster, because it happens so early. Also, if you think about it, this was good in the Philippines because the two biggest industries are fishermen and rice, coconut, and sugarcane plantations. So their work there started before dawn. And what we even saw in the film as well, after Mass, they have a little party in the churchyard.
And that's the part when I watched the movie before, hearing more about this tradition, I just thought that was typical Hollywood. There's like really going to be stands and people eating at 5 a.m. It's so cool.
It is really cool. And what is really funny, our song for tonight, it's almost like a theme, like the Simbang Gabi is the theme tonight, because they sing in our song about one of the foods that are served outside of church. So they have these special holiday delicacies for breakfast. So they have the Bing Bingka, which are rice cakes served with salted egg. They have the Puto Bumbang, which is steamed purple rice pastries seasoned with lots of butter, grated coconut, and muscovado sugar, which sounds awesome to me. There's also Sokolate, that is hot chocolate from Loco Coco, or Salabat, which is ginger tea. They typically went with rice-based food to fill the stomachs of the farmers and the fishermen, because rice was cheap and a primary staple, so they wanted things full of pastries because they were going into hard work right after this Mass. So fill up on heavy carbs so you could go to work.
Good thing you didn't fill up on the heavy carbs before Mass, because then you might go sleepy.
Like Gene.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, and I've heard this before, and I love this one, the Philippines is known for having the world's longest and merriest Christmas season. And people don't believe this, but their Christmas festivities start in September. No, they go from September to January for 4 months until the Epiphany. After summer comes to a close, all the shopping malls, they start to decorate for Christmas. And the decorations are so over the top that they actually have a word for it called banga, which means flamboyant, abundant, spectacular. Some people ask, why do they do this? There's a couple of things attributed, but one thing was how they say, like, Filipinos love to count down to big celebrations. So 100 days until Christmas is September 16th. So they say you'll see a lot of huge Christmas displays in the malls and parks with a big countdown from 100 down to 1. And one of the most popular and common Christmas decorations there in the Philippines is called the parol, and it's the Christmas lantern. And they hang it on their street lamps, and it's the five-pointed star, I think similar to what we saw in Greenland. And they're constructed using bamboo, Japanese paper. They're illuminated with candles, oil lamps, or carbide lamps. Some of the more modern ones, they're made with plastic and metal and illuminated with electric lighting. But this is the iconic symbol of Filipino Christmas.
You know, it's funny, by reflecting on the long September through January, this is real celebration. We know that Christmas decoration displays in department stores, retail shops are in the U.S., but this is different. This is full on, everyone's on board celebration, right? Like, this is the real show.
And Mark, I think the reason why I was aware of this is because I think Filipinos like to promote, hey, we start early. They are proud of it. Some other things, like in this, we've seen before, and I always like, they also get the 13-month pay, that bonus. It's a mandatory benefit that you give on or before December 21st. They get a 13th month of pay, so they get an extra month of pay. The employers, some will give it at the end of the year like that, right before Christmas. Others will split it up and maybe halfway through the year give you half a month, and then at the end of the year give you the other half. That makes your Christmas, I think, a little bit more special if you have an extra month's worth of compensation. Of course, our favorite part, let's talk about their food. There's calderita. Calderita is a special occasion stew that's made for Christmas. And the meat, it depends. You can either have chicken, pork, beef, goat, or lamb. The meat changes, but the actual stew, though, it's savory tomato sauce, liver spread, cheese, olives, potatoes, carrots, and bell peppers. You slow cook it for hours, and it's occasionally enriched with peanut butter, cream, or chili, which made me laugh because the peanut butter, remember, that was in Rwanda. They had peanut butter as well. I have to say, I'm not a big stew fan. This one really doesn't excite me too much, but I will say the next one does. In every Filipino family gathering, there has to be a noodle dish because noodles symbolize long life. So Christmas is no different. So for the Christmas meal, they usually have pancit, bihan, or what they call Filipino spaghetti, because pancit means noodles in Tagalog. And it's those thin rice noodles. You stir fry it with chicken, pork, and shrimp. And you have cabbage, carrots, snow peas. It's like stir fry noodles and mushrooms. You garnish it with either hard or soft boiled quail eggs, scallions, calamansi, which is a small orange citrus fruit that's very popular in the Philippines. And then you toss it with chicken stock and soy sauce. Now, Mark, I'll take that one. That sounds awesome to me.
That does sound delicious, but I don't know. I think I'm going to make you a stew with sauerkraut and cabbage.
Oh, my God. You're giving me nightmares. I can keep pushing the stew right out of my mind because they also have lumpia or lumpiang Shanghai. It's another essential Filipino Christmas dish. And this is an appetizer. So it's a festive appetizer, ground pork, minced carrots, onions, garlic, vegetables, soy sauce, guess what? Rolled up, they're like spring rolls, handmade in large batches. So kind of like the pierogies that we've been talking about, like, you know, Latvians will make them. It's not an egg roll because it's the spring roll. It's the lighter, the thinner wrappers. So then they shallow fry it, give it a light, crispy exterior. And one of the things that we'll learn in our trivia tonight, they serve it with either sweet chili sauce or banana ketchup. So, Mark, I will take the stir-fried noodles and I'll take the lumpia. You take the stew and you go off on your own.
I will.
Well, Mark, as I kind of gave your preview, we're going to hear about a song that relates us back to our movie for tonight.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
The least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music.
All right, that song was Babinka by Ben and Ben. Babinka, it's a love song, and it's by this Filipino indie folk group called Ben and Ben. What they're doing is kind of what we saw here in tonight's movie. It's a love story that takes place over the Simbang Gabi Mass. So the singer meets the love of his life at the Mass. The song is describing the babinka, as we talked about, the rice cakes that they serve afterward. But in the detail that they give it, it's supposed to explain the glow of the Christmas lights, the intimacy of the Mass, the warm ambiance of the church services, so you can understand how it is that they're falling in love in this dimly lit church, in the cool morning, and also just the simple happiness that's created by praying together while attending Mass. How does the babinka get into it? Well, at the end of the song, the singer buys the girl a babinka, which is that sweet cake. It's known for its sweet, creamy taste. So the imagery, if you think about it here, is not just to represent that dish, but guess what, Mark? It's also to express the couple's growing love.
I see what you did.
Yeah. Talking babinka, but I'm really meaning love, right? So the song relates the warmth of this Christmas tradition, young love, but also the devotion of going to nine masses early in the morning, all made special for this babinka theme. So could we have done this any better other than wearing babinka shirts? I mean, come on.
I'm looking on Etsy right now.
There were some other more boppy, poppy kind of songs. This one is more stripped away because it's by a folk group, but it's supposed to have the essence of Christmas, love, joy, hope. Those are the things that really matter, right? And I read an interview with the singer who wrote the song, and he said, hey, this is personal to me because I had an experience like this with Simbang Gabi where I met my special someone, and every time he passes the church where he was that inspired the song, he remembers the nine mornings that they shared together, and this is where they fell in love.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. I love it. What a find.
Many will say that this is one of the most authentic and nostalgic Christmas songs because the importance of that classic Catholic tradition. It's very important. We see it in the movie. We see it in the song. And it's one of the customs. If it's been going on since 1537, obviously it's kind of a big deal. And it's deeply Filipino to its core.
Could that be an early favorite song for the anniversary show?
It kind of grew on me. I don't know. You might be right. Not an obvious choice, but an earworm in the back of your head. Well, Mark, we're off to our silent bite.
Yes.
It's Christmas dinner.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Food they put out for Christmas Eve.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Most of your major food preparation holidays, Christmas.
Eat it.
What's up, food for Santa?
Eat it.
There's no chili. No, chili's not a festive food.
So, Mark, think about this. After a year of training and study, baking can feel like stepping into combat. I mean, we're right there. Every move is going to matter, and our precision is what is going to determine our victorious outcome. So, we are marching toward that fateful day when we need to finally take up our arms in the kitchen. And what I realize is we need a well-laid battle plan. What is our battle plan? That's our recipe, Mark. We're fresh-faced. We have not been to war yet. You know, we haven't tackled the progs yet. So I figured that we need a recipe that we can trust, because the recipe is going to be our difference between triumph and defeat. The easiest thing to do, we could go back to our guests and we could ask Inga or we could ask Gary for the perfect recipe. And then I started looking around and there was like hundreds on the internet. And they all claim, as every good Latvian should, they all claim to make the very best pierogies. And so I was like, well, how are we going to navigate through all of these? They all had great ratings and they all had good pictures. And so then I thought there were a couple of them that had stories with them. And I thought, well, we could take a different approach. Maybe we could pick the recipe based on the story behind the recipe. So it's not just a series of steps, it's reflecting that person's memories. Because I think the recipe's history is what makes it so meaningful. Since we had a number of options, I thought, well, this could be kind of a little game and we could redo the four and we could think about it. And then we can decide which recipe it is that we want to pick.
So we're going to pick the recipes based on a story you're going to tell?
That's the plan. Let's see how well this sorts out. All we're going to do is read the stories tonight, and then we can decide by next show if this is going to work. So number one, and I'm doing these all anonymously. So number one says, this recipe is a family tradition. It is a food that is close to my heart. And these are all pierog recipes. Pierog. I got to roll my R's. I'm terrible. This is a food that is close to my heart. Close due to happy memories and the fact that it is a family recipe. It is made by my grandmother, myself, and now my son. This is a recipe that has passed down through the generations in all households of Latvian descent. One of my earliest food memories is standing in my great-grandmother's kitchen. My grandmother and great-aunt would also be present. It would be a day or two before Christmas Eve. The kitchen would be full of glorious cooking smells and traditional delights being prepared for the family's Christmas feast. The table would be covered with flour and piles of dough. Nimble fingers would shape buns filled with bacon and onion perfectly. Hundreds would be made from that kitchen. When the extended family was all together on Christmas Eve, the pierog dogs would disappear quickly, then they could be passed around. After a late night of celebrating, the take-home pierog became an easy and traditional Christmas Day breakfast. That's a story. All right? You heard that one. That was number one.
Sounds like it was AI generated.
Number two. I'm going to just stumble through pierog. Would Inga tell us how to say it? How do I say it again?
Well, she was calling them P-dogs.
P-dogs. Maybe that's what I'll say. I'll use that. That's easy for me to say.
That's what she said, that her children's friends, because they couldn't say pierog, they would say P-dogs.
Oh, see, you roll your R's good. So I'm going to say P-dogs. Okay. You may be wondering, why P-dogs? Well, my Latvian grandfather, Ludwig, was a huge personality and is sadly missed. He arrived in England after World War II, when the Soviet Union occupied Latvia in 1945. Sadly, this continued for so long that my grandfather remained in England. Latvia did not regain independence until August 21st, 1991. I always remember my grandfather's pea dogs at Christmas. On Christmas Eve, when 12 o'clock, present opening time, felt like light years away for an 8-year-old, I recall the sweet, scented pine tree with its crackling candles softly warming the room, the Latvian music, and the homemade wine. Baking has played a mystical role in Latvian tradition. Bread was sacred. In pagan times, it was taught that if a piece of bread was dropped on the floor, it must be retrieved and kissed by way of an apology. The pea dogs are a household recipe. Each home had their own version. There would be much gossip between the Latvian women about their pea dogs. You could build a house with hers. Latvian cooking is earthy and honest. This recipe is one taken from a Latvian recipe book published by the Ladies Auxiliary of the Latvian Relief Society. So that is number two, Ludwig's recipe.
I don't know, Bob. I'm just really skeptical about these stories. And should we be picking a story based on how well someone writes? Maybe they write really well, but they can't bake for anything.
Well, wait. Let's try number three. They are delicious little nuggets of bread dough stuffed with a sweet onion and bacon mixture. Wherever you find a person of Latvian descent, you will find a version of this treasured and very tasty recipe. When Anna Rands immigrated, she was escaping Russian oppression of her small Baltic country. She came to Montreal alone and learned French and English while working as a head cashier at Steinberg's grocery store by day and in a little restaurant on St. Catherine Street by night. She made friends. She met her husband and moved to a mining town in northern Quebec. She lost her husband and had to raise their two small sons on her own. Anna had a cousin in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, where she decided to relocate with her two boys. There were a few Latvian families there who worked as tailors and cooks, so Anna came and worked as a cook at the local nursing home. Anna's food was delicious. She liked the work and the people. She adored her boys, and the family thrived and enjoyed great friendships in the small maritime town. Anna's neighbors looked out for her. She had a little dog and a lovely home. She was a large, strong woman, and the boys called her Mama Rosenkunz, which means Mrs. Roly-Poly. She laughed. She absolutely loved that. This is Anna's recipe for those bacon rolls. She contributed to the lives of many elderly people by cooking wonderful food for them at the nursing home. She adored her family and made the world a friendlier place, despite or perhaps because of narrowly escaped her country under Soviet rule. Mark, did that move you?
Blah, blah, blah. No, not at one bit. I think these are all lies, Bob. I think you ate some of those 14 different varieties that you bought and you start dreaming this stuff up. I don't buy from it. That sounds like a Hallmark movie gone wrong. So Mrs. Roly-Poly.
I was going to say, didn't Mrs. Roly-Poly even move you? Mama, no. Rosenkunz? All right. Yeah. One last chance. Number four. I want to talk about my father's mother, my grandmother. Her name was Astra Akis, and she died in 1992. Astra and her husband, my grandfather, immigrated to Canada from Latvia after the Second World War. They fled Latvia when the Soviet Union reoccupied that country in 1944. After the war, they ended up in a displaced persons camp in Germany, and from there they made their way to Canada. All three of them worked in a bush camp near Nipigon, Ontario. My grandmother was a bull cook, the person preparing meals at the camp and doing other chores. When I was a kid for summer vacation, we would drive to Thunder Bay, Ontario to visit my grandparents, who settled there after working in the bush camp. The evidence that my grandmother, who was always well-dressed and liked nice things, actually once worked in a rugged bush camp was a giant cast iron skillet she always had on her stove. It was an implement she used at the camp that, because of its enormous size, could prepare a lot of food, which was handy when she had 400 grandkids visiting. In that skillet, she would fry eggs for breakfast, flour and fry fish, such as pike for lunch, and fry thick pork chops or Latvian-style hamburger steaks for dinner. Everything she cooked in that skillet tasted so much richer than they did at home, and it wasn't until I was an adult that I figured out why. She fried everything in lard, or a mix of lard and butter. Some would not call that healthy, but my grandmother lived to 89, and beyond cooking with lard, she enjoyed a daily shot or two of vodka. Another thing my grandmother cooked in that skillet was the filling she used to make pea dogs, small, savory, Latvian-style bacon rolls. Pea dogs, since ancient times, have probably been the most popular party snack in Latvia. Whenever we visited my grandmother, she always made dozens of pea dogs, and that was a good thing because every member of the family loved eating them day or night. Mark, are you crying yet?
No, Bob, I'm sorry. Two of these are from Canada. Why the hell am I going to follow a recipe for pea dogs from Canada?
I don't know, eh? They're nice. They're friendly.
Well, actually, they're just going to be the 51st state anyway. We're going to put extra tariffs on these pea dogs coming in from Canada.
Come on, Ludwig. Mrs. Roly-Poly, Grandma working in the bush camp? None of this. Ooh, you're a hard nut to crack. All right.
Well, it's all made up. It's not true. How did you validate these, Bob?
Well, I did not. I couldn't, but some of the details. I mean, who would put their well-dressed grandmother in a bush camp? Who would admit that Grandma was Mrs. Roly-Poly?
Hey, you know what? There's some creative writing out there. I think these all might be shams.
Well, I'm going to ask all our listeners to send in your votes. 1, 2, 3, or 4. And now, my friend, on to trivia.
It's trivia. It's trivia. Trivia.
Talk about diversity. The Philippines has more than 7,600 islands. It's one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. There are beaches, coral reefs, volcanoes, mountains, rainforests, and unique native species. And you know what? I've never been there, and now I'm kind of wishing I'd been there. The Filipino culture is a fascinating blend of different influences. It is an Asian country that was shaped by Spanish colonization and then served under American rule. So if you think about it, you have a mix of Asian, Spanish, and Western traditions. And with a wide range of foods, languages, and customs, it naturally gives rise to some fascinating trivia. So, Mark, we wondered if you knew that there is a popular street food called balut. Balut, which is partially developed duck egg embryo that is boiled or steamed and eaten from the shell. And Mark, have you ever seen this? Ugh. Okay. Or we considered asking you about the hanging coffins of Sagada, the Philippines. These coffins are carved by the individual before they die. And if that person is too weak or ill to do so, their son or the other relative does it. And when the person dies, they're put in a fetal position in the coffin, and it's then tied to a cliff. So you see all these coffins hanging from a cliff. We thought to question you, how about this fact? Did you know that the Philippines and the Vatican City are the only two countries in the world that still don't allow divorce? Only those two. We wanted to drill you about a favorite condiment in the Philippines that developed from a mass tomato shortage and an overproduction of bananas. So guess what? They made banana ketchup. And I want to try that. I really do.
I would be curious. I could do that. I wonder if I could actually sprinkle that on my duck egg embryo. If I eat it, I'll just be in my casket hanging on a cliff.
Just don't serve it with sauerkraut.
There you go.
Or how about the fact that spider fighting using live arachnids is a popular game with kids there? Or if you think that things come bigger in Texas, well, we wondered if you knew that in the Philippines, they have the largest eagle in the world. It stands about 3.5 feet tall, and it has a 6-foot wingspan. Or do you know that they have the largest number of wild pigs of any country? Or that Manila has 41,000 people per square mile, which is nearly 4 times as dense as New York City?
That's enough. I don't want to hear anymore.
I know. It's bursting our brains. But instead, this is the one we decided. We thought we'd pick your brain about an odd social phenomenon in the Philippines where a certain song has incited violence and numerous murders in karaoke bars. People now avoid singing the song in public to avoid trouble or out of a superstitious fear that the song has been taken off playlists because of it. And the question is, what is the name of this killer song?
Sweet Caroline.
Hey, don't sing it.
What else song could it be? How about She Bangs, She Bangs?
So, if you know, we have something that reminds us of you. At first glance, you notice its fashionable shape and color. It turns the ordinary into something remarkable. You admire the eye-catching design and the subtle details that give it character. You recognize the finer elements, the sheen, the precision, the style. Like you, it has a presence. It carries attitude, and it adds personality wherever it goes. Yes, It is the 4F sticker. It may be small, but it makes a big statement, and it is uniquely yours. So you can claim it now by sending your answer to thefestivefans@gmail.com.
I'm exhausted, Bob.
I know. So I have to send you out with a quote that is, "Christmas, Christmas, a time when all the world seemed to take a breath and forget, even just a little while, how harsh life could be." And that's by TJ Klun. That is nice. Now, Mark, next episode, we travel to the small, narrow country of Panama, a natural joiner that geographically links the Central and South America and the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. We will be watching the 2020 holiday film, The Family Tree, which is available to stream on Tubi or to rent through Amazon Prime Video and Fandango at home. And Mark, one more little quote to celebrate our moms out there. A mom's hug is the best gift under the tree.
Oh, now that got me. All those fake stories about P-Dogs didn't get me, but that got me.
And now we have to ask, Mother, may I end the podcast?
I hope so.
At least I didn't say, Mrs. Roly-Poly, can I end the podcast?
Bob, once again, we have ventured into a new country. This was a deep dive of one of the better movies we've seen in our 3 years.
Absolutely. And that was fun. And like you said, I didn't know a lot about the Philippines, but that was great.
I think it's time to say goodnight and get ready for another adventure.
Yeah, I'm going to start getting my decorations ready for September.
I'm okay with that.
Me too. So thank you, Mark. See ya.
Good night, Bob.
Good night.
Actually, we're done.
It's over. Over, over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.